like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And like many, I'm stunned and heartbroken, feeling sick, really. If you'd like to express your feelings on the results, Rob Lori will invite your calls today on WMNF on Radioactivity at 11 a.m. right after Talking Animals this morning. Meanwhile, my guest today is Adam Sigalski, founder and executive director of One Protest, a Florida-based advocacy organization perhaps best known for its high-profile successful effort to help halt the Florida bear hunt. A guiding principle of One Protest is the belief that the most powerful and effective advocacy comes from passionate citizen activists promoting change within their immediate circle of friends, family, neighbors, and coworkers. No less important than that philosophy, One Protest makes itself available to help activists or organizations mount the most effective campaigns possible. And while highly renowned for helping to end the bear hunt, One Protest casts a wider net than just animal welfare, also throwing its expertise behind environmental issues and other social justice campaigns. We'll hear more about One Protest and the strategies and smarts behind high-level advocacy when I speak in a few moments here on Talking Animals with Adam Sigalski, who will also be a featured speaker at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest this Saturday. And we may get a sneak preview of that talk in the course of this morning's conversation. Later on, I'll play back a brief conversation I recorded Monday with Laura Coffey, author of My Old Dog, Rescued Pets with Remarkable Second Acts, a book that touts the virtues of adopting senior shelter dogs by profiling an array of folks who've done just that, with a foreword written by Nico Case. And Laura will be speaking at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading this Saturday, November 12th, and will be appearing at a book signing dog adoption literacy event at the Barnes & Noble in Clearwater on Sunday, November 13th. But right now, let's get to Adam and One Protest with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Adam Sigalski to Talking Animals. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good, Adam. So I think before we get any further, I don't know if you want to first say anything about the presidential results, or if you'd rather avoid that topic, but I at least wanted to give you the option just because it's, I think, pretty stunning to many of us, and it's hard to know what to do with those feelings in some cases.
Yeah, you know, a lot of us in the animal welfare movement constantly have, you know, victories are rare, and we have a lot of defeat, and for me, I guess what's most upsetting is I actually know activists who are on do animal welfare voted for Trump, and it's almost like shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, if you just look at his sons are trophy hunters, he wants to, you know, deregulate the EPA, pull out the Paris Climate Agreement. It's just actually shocking that someone who cared about the environment and animals would vote for someone who's pretty much, you know, his sons are going to go on a hunting rampage, is what I've read in a Field and Stream article where they want to start hunting. It's pretty shocking. I'm in a nightmare. I can't wake up.
Yeah. I think from any number of angles, many of us feel shocked. Whether we should or shouldn't is a whole other conversation. And what to do to carry on and forge ahead is probably yet another conversation as well. Mm-hmm. And like I said a moment ago, right here on WMNF at 11 o'clock, Rob Lori will be opening the phones to take those kind of calls, and people can express her feelings and hopefully sort through it and maybe end up feeling a little bit better. So that's coming up just a little after 11 here on WNF. But let's muddle through ourselves here, Adam. Let's forge ahead the best we can. So someone running an advocacy organization tends to be a lifer, I found, and or at least operating in a related field. So rather than they don't usually come to it from, say, air conditioning repair or something like that. So let's trace your career path a bit, because I'm going to guess there's probably a pretty steady arc over the years.
Basically, I grew up in the art field. And so what happened was, you know, as working for different design agencies and advertising agencies and doing graphic design, I got into, kind of by chance, I was invited to a circus protest. And when I got there, I saw the messaging and the signs. And that was kind of when it kind of sparked to me. I thought it could look better. It could have more impactful seeing being in the advertising industry and then seeing the activist signs. I thought that I could probably really help out and try to change the messaging. And that was really how I got my start in this kind of activism I'm doing now.
And so, Adam, how long ago was that? When was that exactly that you saw the circus protests and said, hey, this is fine, but there's many ways to improve upon it?
It was 2006, 10 years ago, I got invited to my first Ringling Brothers protest. And we mostly had signs provided by PETA and other group ADI, Animal Defenders International. And then one of the problems, too, was our literature we got from PETA. And I think PETA does great work. No organization is perfect, but they have some negative connotations. When you hand a PETA flyer, they think we're PETA activists. When we're local, we live there. And so I actually wanted to redesign the literature because I wanted to make sure it was coming from a local group. Not that the PETA literature was bad, but I was definitely getting some negative feedback on that.
That's interesting because one of the things we've touched on in this show a number of times over the years is that at this point, and probably for some years now, really, PETA, I think the reaction to PETA on a specific campaign or effort can often cut both ways. And there are many fans in the animal welfare, animal rights realm, and there are a lot of people who would sprint the other direction if they saw PETA coming or there was some sort of PETA association. So it's become pretty polarizing in that way.
No, they have. And I think, you know, every location you protest, there's different demographics you kind of look into. And I think Jacksonville is a very conservative place. And, you know, some of the stuff they do, I think, is a little out there when they put people in cages and fake blood on them. And that might work in some areas, but some areas that won't work. And so that's why I think that, like I said, they do have a polarizing reputation now, as you said. So that was one of the reasons I want to do some of my own literature.
So the first thing that you went to where you had this notion of, hey, maybe I can improve upon their messaging and their design and stuff, was a circus protest. What were your own kind of early issues that you cared about most as you moved into this direction?
Well, when I was 16 years old, I ended up, I grew up, seeing those commercials, beef is what's for dinner, and, with the music playing, and it looks all happy. Come home, your mom has a steak ready, and wow, let's eat our steak. And then, one day I was in biology class. They didn't show really a factory farming video. They were showing like agriculture and just the food industry and factory farming. I became a vegetarian that day. I just kind of a light went off my head and was like, I saw like the reality of what these animals go through. And that was my first real kind of experience getting in. I wouldn't say I was getting into animal welfare issues, but it made me really sympathetic to what those animals were going through.
And so was that as you moved into advocacy, was vegetarianism, veganism, et cetera, then kind of a core issue for you?
Yeah. I definitely went through my angry vegan phase, as a lot of us do, where, when I was at work, I would talk to people about veganism and what they're eating. And, at first you do it, coming from an angry place. But, now when I talk about veganism with people, I say, why don't you try doing it one day a week, 2 days a week? There's more of a compromising attitude now. But that was pretty much the catalyst getting into animal issues. And then, doing the circus protesting in 2006 was what kind of everything started to come together. And I realized, wow, I can put my skill set to use. And one thing I did, too, is I coached lacrosse, high school lacrosse for several years. So I already had kind of an organizing skill set, I thought. And so I thought, as the years went by and I was protesting, I kind of took the group over, and I think that those skills helped as well.
Was this then the group that we now know as One Protest, or was there a group back then that you're talking about that then later you ended up either co-founding or launching a separate group that is now called One Protest?
Well, basically, a woman, her name Kiki, she ran the group here in Jacksonville, and I think around 2010-11, she moved away, and so I kind of filled the void. It wasn't even where I was like, I'm going to take over the group. It was almost I had to take over the group, and what happened was, too, we had really, really low numbers of people coming out to protest, and so I branded the group Jack's Protest, created a logo for us, and then, social media was really coming to its own, so using social media, branding our group, and organizing people, the group started to really kind of grow in numbers from, 12 or 13 to, last year we had, upwards of between 70 to 100 people over the weekend protest.
Well, I guess that brings us to a question I was going to get to later, but maybe this is the time. What, over those years, from first kind of getting involved, your angry vegan days, et cetera, to the present, what would you mark the impact that social media has had on advocacy?
Well, one thing we do when we do our protests is, we take a lot of photos. And one thing we do now, as well as we we'll actually have investigators in the shows, behind the shows, and we're protesting out front. And I'll actually take the footage that our investigators get and make a video on the fly during the protest, post it on social media, and definitely getting media coverage from news outlets helps. But when you're kind of doing a full circle thing where I can tell the circus goer going in exactly what they're about to see and show them a video exactly what they're about to see, I think it really hits home and it brings a really powerful message when you're not just protesting, but you're actually, you know, witnessing and showing people about what's happening. And social media has really allowed that to take off. We can post your videos and then people protesting, and it almost becomes not a social event, but, you know, you're taking pictures, it kind of brings people together.
And would you say that also just the impact of social media these days would account for what sounds like a pretty dramatic increase in the number of people that you now attract to when you are doing a given protest, let's say?
Yeah, so, you know, it does. You know, when you use the Facebook creating an event, I mean, without Facebook, the Black Bear protest would have been much harder. But there is, I think, a negative side to social media where, you know, I'll post stuff that kind of, sometimes you have to post a picture that's like a negative picture, a picture of a dead bear that we saw that was killed. But I think sometimes it goes overboard. It can be a turn off to people posting horrible images. I don't want to see that stuff. I mean, I know what goes on. It kind of can cut both ways.
Sure.
So that's one, and see a lot of the negativity. You know, we have a strict policy with people I work with that even if someone comes on our page and is very negative, we just ban and block them. We don't engage in negativity because we're already almost living in negativity, but we deal with the harsh reality with these animals experience. And then kind of stooping yourself down to someone's level to start arguing or yelling or using profanity, we're really against a lot of that stuff on social media. And you can backfire on activists. Like, I know we're angry. When someone's posting like hateful stuff against the hunter, that doesn't help our cause either. So it definitely cuts both ways.
So again, even from what the early days there, it sounds like a lot of it's about crafting and controlling the message.
Yeah, we definitely have a more of a full circle strategy as far as, you know, getting people out, leafleting, protesting, documenting. So it becomes this full circle strategy as opposed to just being protest. And definitely the social media is definitely one of our major tools that's helped us to get where we are today.
The full circle thing is really interesting because I think, I mean, just as you alluded to, the idea that some of you might be out front protesting a certain thing while others might be around back at, let's say, at a circus demonstration, trying to capture footage about what goes on behind the scenes with animals. So then that's really into a whole other realm than just protesting. A lot of those protests show people footage of what the elephants go through, for example. But the fact that you're doing that almost, it sounds like, in real time is certainly a distinguishing factor, I would think, one protest.
And then too, with the messaging, you know, I see groups using signs that have been like the same signs. I have signs that are 10 years old from the original protest, but we're constantly trying to adapt our message and fine-tune it. As Ringling got rid of their elephants, they got rid of them, but the elephants are still living in shackles at Ringling's facility and being rented out and experimented on. So you know, the average person might think, oh, wow, Ringling did a good thing and got rid of their elephants, but the tigers have it just as bad. So this year, we actually shifted our complete message. I mean, last year, we shifted our messaging completely to tigers because the elephants are there, but it's their last show. So we wanted to show that our message is changing, it's adapting. I mean, it almost becomes a marketing warfare with these people because they have big advertising agencies and are always having slick advertising. So we have to counter that with we think, better messaging. And, you know, I think we have history on our side. I mean, these exotic animals do not deserve to be in circuses. And we're showing this truth while they're hiding the truth.
Right. Well, every year since I started the show, even back to the California days, I always do at least one annual Ringling-related show tied to whenever they were appearing in town. And out in California, it was usually summer, July. And out here, it's usually the very beginning of January. In fact, I just saw something about, I think, at least the Orlando arena there. There's Ringling ads or email or something about them coming there. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people may, if they're not paying close attention, may not have realized with the news of halting use of the elephants is they in no way promised and in no way are otherwise not using animals in the Circus Act. They're just not using elephants any longer. So like you say, there's tigers and depending on which unit, any number of other animals that are still very much part of those shows. So
yeah, the tigers have. I mean, they sit back there and pace back and forth, and sometimes they're just crying, crying for hours, like how so. But yeah, and one thing Ringling does too is the language they use. It's a weapon they use against, I mean, not a weapon, but they use this language like the bullhook. Oh, it's a guiding tool. No, it's a weapon. And one of our posters is circus training tools, but it has it like crossed out and says weapons. Like a bullhook, a whip, and a stun gun are not tools. Those are weapons used against the animal. So, but then again, you got to look at Ringling. They built their business off the backs of animals for over 100 years. I mean, there's pictures from like the 1930s and 1940s, having, you know, dozens of elephants paraded down the road with guys with baseball bats on the top of them, and you're in shackles. Like, it's almost like a slavery scene. And, you know, we definitely come a long way, but there's still a lot more to do with exotic animals and entertainment.
As you kind of noted, I mean, and it pains me to say this, but, I mean, Ringling is incredibly savvy, maybe even brilliant, wouldn't be overstating the word, at marketing. And so
they have a great ground game. They come in usually now it's a little, they change a little bit because of the elephants and ticket sales have been down here. We notice crowds are a lot lower, but they come in some 6 months ahead of time. And we know this because I have friends in the advertising agency, and they'll tell me that Ringling's trying to buy ads on either news outlets or their magazines 6 months ahead of time.
Yeah.
Buying up all the airwaves. And you know, Kenneth Sells, who owns Ringling, is a billionaire. And they sponsor truck rallies. So they have unlimited funds to do whatever they want as far as advertising goes. But, you know, we're hoping that public perception is changing. And you know, hopefully, you know, years from now, circuses will be pretty much left as human performers.
Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Adam Sigalski, executive director of One Protest, an advocacy organization perhaps best known for its high-profile, successful effort to help halt the Florida bear hunt. Also, Adam will be speaking this Saturday at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest. If you'd like to ask a question of Adam in the meantime or offer a comment, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So along those lines, we do have a caller that's been holding for a few minutes. Let's get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Adam Sigalski.
Yes, well, thanks to Adam for all of his incredible work, and I think that it's very timely, given what happened yesterday in the election, that we mention that Donald Trump and his advisors are sworn enemies of animal welfare protection statute and regulation. I think we should remind ourselves that one of Trump's biggest advisors is a man who has an organization called Protect the Harvest that is working tirelessly to block and repeal any laws that oppose cruelty to animals, including in the animal entertainment industry. Trump is also allied with the governor of Iowa, who signed the first ag-gag law. He's also affiliated with another very wealthy Iowa farmer who could end up being agriculture secretary. All of this will affect animal welfare in the animal entertainment industries. And of course, we have those photos of Trump's sons doing staged trophy hunts of rare and endangered species in Africa. And when Trump was asked about it, he said that he might appoint Donald Jr. to be the head of the Department of the Interior. I would like your guest to talk about what we can do under this anti-animal rights, anti-animal welfare new president that we've made the huge mistake of electing.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. And Adam, feel free to respond. I'll just quickly.
I hit my phone on hold accidentally. Sorry.
You didn't hear any of his question or comment?
I heard about it. You know, I heard what he said, and, you know,
okay,
he nailed it on the head. It's like, you know, what he said, I'd read about a lot of that stuff. And, you know, when Ringling got rid of their elephants, Donald Trump tweeted about how disappointed he was, and now he's not, like, going to the circus, basically. And if that doesn't tell you something right there, and, you know, I'm a little bit kind of just taken back today thinking about how we proceed in taking on this. You know, a lot of these fights will end up being state by state, like with ag-gag laws, which pretty much, if people don't know what those are, it's where if you go inside and you film at a factory farm, and I have friends that have done this for Mercy for Animals. They go in and they basically work on these farms for weeks and months, and sometimes they've actually had to kill the animals to get the footage. And if that footage comes out, you can get arrested for that. It's illegal. You know, and that's what ag-gag's trying to stop, all that stuff. But yeah, it's scary. And I think, you know, we just have to keep, you know, in our certain circles where, like, protesting circuses, I mean, we just kind of had to keep kind of doing what we're doing. As far as I haven't really thought about, you know, how to kind of tackle a Trump administration as far as animal welfare goes.
You're hoping
I'm still stuck.
Yes, I hear you. It's interesting, too, that as the caller was framing that question, I was thinking that probably about 2 months or so ago, maybe a bit longer even now, Kathleen Parker, who is a Washington Post columnist, conservative columnist at that, wrote a column about how Trump would be bad for the animals, and just covered a lot of the ground we're sort of talking about in some other history of Trump's, and of course the sons being hunters and other things. And just her broad premise was that if Trump were in office, it would be tough for animals of all kinds at all levels. So, but again, we probably all hoped that wouldn't really be something we'd have to seriously ponder, unlike what we're dealing with this morning. So Adam, tell me, in your mind, what are the components of really effective advocacy?
Well, one of the things I stress when I do my talk is you have to know your target. Like, be an expert at what you're going to protest or you're going after. The bear hunt became basically before June 24th of last year, I really had not done anything for black bears in Florida. But when the hunt passed, I saw how ridiculous it was using their faulty science, old science, and as more special interest group pushing hunting. And so I kind of, you know, hooked up with a few people who knew a lot about the bears, studied, and became an expert so that I could go kind of toe-to-toe with an FWC person as far as talking about bear habitat and what's happening to it. And then from that, you really have to sit down and plan out what are your end goals? What is your, if you could, the best case scenario, like with the bear, stop the bear hunt. But if you didn't stop the bear hunt last year, what would we do after? So I had a whole a strategy about how we would tackle it, from working with different groups, protesting, leafleting, you know, outreach programs, trying to get media coverage, and then we document the bears being killed. And so we had a full circle plan with it. And then when the hunt didn't get stopped last year, we just built a momentum from last year and did the same thing. But I think we got so much momentum going is when it kind of really took off. Put down a couple of plans for it.
Well, a couple of things there. One is, it sounds like there's a key part to this is really formulating a very specific plan and having levels and stages very much together before you even put any part of that plan in motion, so that whatever happens next, surprised, good news, bad news, whatever, you have the next step already organized and ready to go. But also, when you're talking about, the hunt is trying to stop the hunt last year, I think I remember reading coverage when the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission did decide there would be no bear hunt this year. I think I remember reading that you were sort of surprised by that decision. So what was it besides momentum, do you think, that accounts for them making that decision this year?
Well, I think the FWC has never been challenged like this publicly by anybody. They pretty much, I guess they kind of work in it. They do what they want to do. It's a very hunting-centric group. Now, they do good work around the state. I spent a year or so going after them, but I don't think they knew what kind of hit them. You know, we had call-in events, emailing campaigns, and the media turned against the FWC. I mean, I did an interview with National Geographic, Washington Post, and a few places in England, and I think when they're getting all this public pressure, people are calling in, their approval ratings, down the gutter, and 90% of Floridians don't want this bear hunt. I think they have to seriously look at, Floridians don't want this, and we cause so much noise, and, Chuck O'Neill and his group, Speak Up Wakaiva, had a lawsuit against them. So, and we helped Chuck with the lawsuit as well as help getting funding for it. So I think we had, you have a lawsuit happening. The public is outraged. I think the FWC was like, wait a second, what's happening to us? I think they're putting a pause on the hunt to see what happens. I think that is I think the public pressure just mounted so much that they wanted to stop and assess what was really going on.
Well, and again, I think too, the idea that with social media and then regular media really exposing what the bear hunt really was and the numbers involved and how they arrived at that decision kind of cast a spotlight on the whole process that I think probably made the commission squirm, and because the public was outraged once they knew about more. So just like anything else, once it's really put in the light like that, people can get really upset, and then contacting that commission and expressing that outrage, and then media of different kinds are following a step behind that, and then they're starting to really feel some pressure.
Well, we use a lot of their own words against them. And like, I don't think they've ever been protested before, not to my knowledge. They've never had like 28 city protests against them, with news outlets from all across the state, country, and international, like, shining a light on them. Like, I mean, how they kept saying this is a scientific, well-regulated hunt. That's their own words. How can that be when you sell 3,778 permits to kill 305 bears, or 300 bears, or 320 bears? How can you call that science? That's like over 11 hunters per one bear. And their data was all over the place. And they even admit that, one of their things was bear-human interactions, from people basically not putting their trash away. That can be solved with bear-proof law.
Yeah.
90% of those instances can be proved by humans behaving properly. It's not the bear's fault. You move in the forest, tear it down, and they want to come where they used to live. And what are you expecting? You can't blame the bear. You have to put blame on the people. And I think the hunt was just the easiest solution for them. And
Well, and it was interesting because we did a number of shows or interviews in and around that topic at the time. And one of the many things that just seemed kind of really hard to reconcile was that at the time there was still this bear census that was underway but had not been completed and wasn't expected to be completed for some months, and yet they were saying, well, meanwhile, we're going to go ahead and kill these bears. It's like, well, you know, if you don't know what the population is, how can you even think, if it made sense to do any kind of bear cull to begin with, if you don't know what numbers you're dealing with to cull from or to start off with? So
that was one of the things, I think, as well. One of the facts, when you look at that, it just shows you what is really driving this hunt. Is it special interest groups? I mean, this year, right before the hunt, which is the most asinine thing I've ever heard in my life, you know, the NRA came out for the black bear hunt. And I'm a gun owner. I'm for Second Amendment rights. So I'm not, you know, against guns, but I don't think the NRA should be sticking their nose in a hunt issue when they said that black bears were terrorizing families and neighborhoods and children could not go out and play. They said that. It was in the papers. And that doesn't show you, and the NRA was sending letters out to all their people, hey, you better go to this meeting and stand up for hunting because they're going to take your guns away next, which it's pure, it's not going to happen. Chronic causes hysteria, which is just not there. So it shows you what, it showed their colors when they actually came out and who's really behind them. And one more point, the Safari Club, SCI, Safari Club International, last year we were trying to get a temporary emergency injunction to stop the hunt. They sent a lawyer. A lawyer was sitting there with the FWC, SCI, the most murderous group in the world towards animals, killing all the elephants, rhinos, everything. They were sitting with the FWC. I mean, is that not a conflict of interest or what?
Well, a key word that you mentioned in that response was the hysteria that was caused not only by the NRA intervening, but just generally. And again, that's what a group like yours can help really expose. And once it's out there, it's like, okay, this is hysteria. Let's really look at the facts. Here they are. And of course, there was another thing that we talked a lot of on the show as well, is once the hunt was looming, the license fees just seemed like a huge cash cow on top of everything else. So, I mean, there was just so many things that seemed problematic. But again, it was only, I think, through really, really presenting that in a broad, powerful way to the public that the result that you guys helped to achieve happened. So,
one thing kind of interesting is we had a petition out last year. I think it got over 137,000 signatures on change.org. Well, the FWC, or a satellite group of the FWC, came out with their own petition to try to counter our petition about support the FWC with their science-based, you know, animal management. Their petition got a few hundred signatures. I mean, it was like, it's like a bear hunter cannot go in the corner and hold a sign saying, please let me kill my bear. Give me my right to kill my bear. So we definitely have that edge because I think we're on the right side of history and we're protecting wildlife. So it's easy for us to get our message across as opposed to the hunter can't do what we do, like stage a big protest,
sure,
pro-hunting protest.
Right. Well, it's also a matter of what kind of agenda do you guys have relative to what kind of agenda do the hunters and the commission have too under any kind of scrutiny. So let me let folks know one more time. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Adam Sagalski, Executive Director of One Protest, a Florida-based advocacy organization. Adam will be speaking this Saturday at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest, but he's available here right now. We just have another minute or two with Adam. If you'd like to ask a quick question, 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So we have in our remaining minute or two, Adam, do you want to just briefly outline or give a little sneak preview of if folks were to see you at VegFest on Saturday, what your talk might be dealing with?
Well, I'm going to talk about some of my new campaigns coming up. We're doing a campaign against a humane. In 2 weeks, we're doing a protest in Asheville against a woman who does humane slaughter. And she paints in this light like the animal, it's a healthy animal that does not want to be killed. And they keep talking about humane slaughter. And we think it's a very slippery slope when people start using the term humane slaughter because the animal doesn't want to die. And when you're slitting its throat and you're putting its knee on it, I mean, how is that humane in any way? So that's one of our campaigns. And then also, too, I'm going to be talking about just about like the circus campaign and how we're changing our messaging. And then a little bit about the bear hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to do part at the end of it. I give tips for activists and how to maybe be more effective activists at the end.
Well, this sounds very cool. What time is your talk on Saturday? I did have that scheduled at one point
It's 3:00.
3:00. Okay, yeah. So that's 3:00 this Saturday. And
we'll
that's
a table there, too, so they can come by and stop by and see your table.
Yeah, cool. So that's at Tampa Bay Veg Fest, and that's at Okeechobee Fort Brook Park. And the Veg Fest runs from 10 to 5, but Adam will be speaking there at 3 p.m. So, Adam, thank you very, very much. We've been speaking with Adam Sagalski of One Protest. The website is oneprotest.org. And, of course, needless to say, they're on Facebook and other social media. And the Veg Fest website is TampaBayVegFest.org. So, Adam, thanks so much for all the great work you do, and thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
No, thanks for having me on, and take care, and hang in there.
Yeah, right back at you and beyond. All right. Thanks,
take
Adam.
Take care. Bye-bye.
In a few moments, I'll play back my brief conversation with Laura Coffey, author of My Old Dog, Rescued Pets with Remarkable Second Acts. We'll be speaking at the Tampa Bay Festival of Reading this Saturday and appearing Sunday at Barnes & Noble's in Clearwater. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner, and I'm happy to present a new piece by an old fave from his recent appearance on This Is Not Happening, the Comedy Central show hosted by Ari Shaffir. This is Brian Regan with the first portion of a piece called Boo Sailboats, a campaign-related piece in a way that might actually put a spring in your step on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animal.
Years ago, I was a campaign manager for a dog. I'm not lying. I was a campaign manager for a dog. I'm not making this up. You guys know, remember Bud Light had Spuds McKenzie? Yeah? Well, I wasn't qualified to be his campaign manager. But I was the campaign manager for Alex the dog from the Stroh's beer commercials. Now, Stroh's beer used to be one of the most popular beers in the country, and then I got involved. The Stroh's ads, they would have, Alex would go get beers for his owner, and everybody loved the ads, so they thought, let's capitalize on this, let's have him run for president of the United States. So, yeah. So Alex can't talk because he's a dog, so they thought, let's get like a funny campaign manager, and that's where I failed miserably. And what they would do is they want us to go around to different cities, and we had to do like 6, 7, 8 events a day with this dog, and I had to do this campaign speech to get this dog elected. I'm not exaggerating when I say that every single one of these events was worse than any hell gig I've ever done before or since. And I had like 8 a day. We would have to do radio stations. We wouldn't bring Alex because he's a dog and can't talk. And we'd show up, and they go, where's Alex? And I'm like, well, I don't know if they told you, but Alex is a dog. He ain't got no vocal cords or nothing. I don't know if that's true, but he can't talk. And I said, I'm Brian. I'm his campaign manager. I'm going to do all the talking. They go, ah. I'm like, damn. We go into the studio, and they would have a microphone on the floor with a bowl of water, and they would say, we were hoping we'd get him to bark into the microphone. And I'm like, I gotta get a manager or something, because I'm getting upstaged by a dog that ain't here.
That was Brian Regan with the first slice of a piece called Boo Sailboats, taken from his appearance a week or so ago on the Comedy Central show This Is Not Happening. Now let's move to the brief conversation I recorded Monday with Laura Coffey, author of My Old Dog, Rescued Pets with Remarkable Second Acts, who will be at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading and also appearing at the Barnes & Noble in Clearwater for a special event there, both happening this weekend. Here's Laura Coffey now on Talking Animals.
Welcome back, Laura.
Oh, thank you very much for having me back.
You bet. Now, of course, your reputation precedes you in a sense because I think you hold the record as the peppiest guest ever on Talking Animals. So let's see
oh,
how you
goodness.
Do. Yeah, well, it's a shorter stint, so we'll see. But maybe you can cram several minutes into our brief chat here. With your book, just there's all kinds of things all about the senior dogs. And just last week on the show, I interviewed the executive director of One Last Treat. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization, but it's military veterans who adopt senior dogs, and especially ones who are ailing or for one reason or another, unfortunately, are about to be euthanized, and either if they're on their own in shelters or if they're with families who may not have the funds to properly handle that, they step in and either adopt a dog for its final days or weeks or months, whatever it might be, or help those families. So anyways, just made me think of you when I did that interview and heard all about their organization. So senior dogs, we love senior dogs.
We do love senior dogs because they're wonderful. They make the best friends. And it's a really, in many ways, the best time of their lives.
Right. So I'm curious, do you get now little messages or do you otherwise hear from folks who've read the book? Again, we want to say it's My Old Dog. dog, rescued pets with a remarkable second act, who read the book and want to share their stories about their senior dogs?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We have a really fun community of senior dog lovers on Facebook at My Old Dog, and we're getting great stories all the time. And I'm really excited that I'm about to come back to, I'm heading back to Florida for some great events. And one of the events will feature a lot of senior dogs that people can come and meet. And I'm particularly looking forward to that, getting to be with these sweet seniors at the event. That is really exciting.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, we'll get into that in one sec for sure. But have there been any particular stories that have struck you as people do write in or post on the Facebook page or whatever about their senior dog stories?
Oh, yeah. You know, one thing that I have found encouraging is I've been kind of plugging in with some groups that are popping up around the country and, you know, local communities that are focusing on helping people who are very sick. Maybe they might be even terminally ill. They might be in hospice and they're not sure what to do with their pets. And many of these pets happen to be older. And so there are some very specific rescue groups that are popping up just to help people in this situation where they get to keep their pets with them for as long as possible, get help with their veterinary costs and caregiving of the pet, and then have the assurance that the pets are going to go to a really loving permanent home when they can no longer stay with the people. And so this has been generating a lot of interest. We've been posting some stories about that.
Yeah, well, real quick maybe, Laura, before we do get into info about your local appearances, can you give me one or two names of those organizations? Because actually that very topic was raised in our interview last week with the folks from One Last Treat, and someone called in or emailed in and wondered about that very thing. So if you could steer people in the direction of organizations, do that, that'd be extra helpful.
Yeah, well, you know, again, they are local, but they're, and I'm not sure about any, there may be some popping up in the Tampa Bay area, but I know one that I focused on quite a bit was called Tyson's Place.
Okay.
They're in Michigan. And then there were others in North Carolina, in Illinois, in California, that are kind of coming along just at this point where people really need the help and they're not sure what to do. And you don't want your pet to end up in a shelter.
Right.
This is your, in many cases, this is your closest family member, and you want to make sure that that animal is going to be okay no matter what happens to you. So this is just such a loving and kind provision that is, I'm very, very hopeful that this will catch on and that more people will start doing this with a specific focus. And of course, you know, it would just be a huge benefit for a lot of people anywhere in the country. You know, people love their animals so much, their family.
No, that's really cool. So it sounds like there's pockets of those organizations. It doesn't sound like they're national in scope or reach just yet.
Not yet. Not that I can tell.
But of course, people do listen to the show, not just in Tampa, so it's still nice to plant that idea out there. So I suppose no matter who's written in, they're still not George Clooney. No matter who's written in, and just, you know, for those who haven't read the book, George Clooney is one of those that Laura did profile, who adopted senior dog and had a great experience. And having said that, let's talk about the local appearances. First of all, the Tampa Bay Times Festival Reading. Tell us about that and what you'll be doing and when.
Yes. So I'm really excited that I've been invited to participate in the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading. It's on Saturday, November 12th, and I'm going to be speaking at 1 o'clock between 1 and 1:45. The event is at the University of South Florida's St. Petersburg campus, and I'm just really excited. I'm hoping to be able to show a short little movie, like a little, it's basically like a trailer about senior dogs and senior rescue. You'll see these beautiful photos of these senior rescue dogs, and then talk about some of the stories in the book, because it just shows how these examples of people who have taken in these dogs, you just see how life-changing it was for them. They did this kind thing, but then their lives got so much better too. And so that it's really, I'm very, very honored and excited that the Festival of Reading wants to put a spotlight on this.
That's so great. And I should note too that with this trailer in mind, that the one thing we haven't talked about the book in passing, well, we didn't mention that there's a foreword by Nico Case, by the way, but what I was about to mention is that there's fantastic photographs all laced throughout the book by Laurie Fusaro, and that's a key element of the book, along with the great stories that you tell with your writing there. So I assume those photos are going to be some that will be represented in that.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
For sure.
And we should note too that the Festival of the Time, the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading, is a non-ticketed event, so you could just turn up to hear Laura talk, and so you'll be talking about senior dogs and or about the book kind of in your stint there from 1 to 1:45, or?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
That is the goal, and I'm very excited about it. I get so enthusiastic telling
Cool. Yes. Well, as I think we've noted, you've never been lacking for enthusiasm in our past encounters. So, all right. So then let's move on to Sunday, because you're also in the area doing something related but kind of different.
Yes. On Sunday afternoon, I will be at the Barnes & Noble in Clearwater from 3 to 6 p.m. And I'll be speaking at 3 o'clock, probably from about 3 to 3:30. I'll actually speak about senior dog rescue and, again, the stories and the message of the My Old Dog book. But the exciting thing about the Barnes & Noble event is that I'm going to be joined by some really wonderful rescue groups, specifically Florida Boxer Rescue and Paulicious Poochie Pet Rescue. I love that name.
Right. Tell me you can keep your face straight when you say that name. But anyways, okay, so Paulicious Poochie Pet Rescue. Why should you have all the fun? But go ahead.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's so nice because both groups help a lot of seniors. I mean, Florida Boxer Rescue, of course, is focused on boxers that can, you know, find themselves needing homes later in life and have a difficult time getting adopted. And so they're going to have a bunch of foster dogs there. And this will be outside the store, like right by the front doors of the store, so you can hug and mingle and get to know these dogs that are living in foster homes now but could be adopted. And then also, Paulicious Poochie Pet Rescue, they focus specifically on helping senior dogs with health issues. A lot of very small dogs. Some of these dogs in the past had been used, in puppy mill type situations. Mm. And the founder of this organization, Jamie McKnight, is just amazing with what she's done. She's helped hundreds of dogs, and she has a really fun Facebook page. And she's bringing some of the most famous Paulicious Poochie rescue dogs to the event, so people will get to meet some of the most famous ones, including Luna and Splinter and Jelly Bean and Eeyore.
Wow.
Those are four of the rescued little dogs that will be there.
I think we've somehow managed to supplant Paulicious Poochie Pet Rescue as the most amusing part of the story. So that's
But they are great. They're based in St. Pete, and they're doing really wonderful work for senior dogs.
That's
locally.
Fantastic. Okay, so again, this has been Laura Coffey. Her book is My Old Dog, Rescued Pets with Remarkable Second Act. She'll be again Saturday at the Tampa Bay Times Festival Reading from 1 to 1:45, and the next day, Sunday, at the Barnes & Nobles in Clearwater from 3 to 6. She'll be talking specifically at 3 p.m., and then all those nice dogs from Florida Boxer Rescue, Paulicious Poochie Rescue, and maybe others will be there as well. So, Laura, we look forward to having you in our fair city. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right. Again, our thanks to Laura Coffey. And after we recorded that interview, she sent me a note because her real sort of day job is she writes and edits and produces stuff for the Today Show's website. And so she sent me a note as a follow-up to our conversation saying that she had written a piece about animal rescue groups for terminally ill people. So I will include that link in a few days' time when I put the audio archive up on talkinganimals.net. There's always a synopsis of the show. So I will, in the portion about our chat here with Laura, I will include the link to that piece. So also, during the show, we've gotten a nice anonymous donor sending in a contribution to the Talking Animals tip jar, which, of course, we're delighted and helps WMNF. So thank you, Anonymous. And coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the noon hour, concerts, a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, again today, very much including your calls about the outcome of the presidential race. And, of course, there'll be news and more with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp, who we wish a speedy recovery to. I think he's down on tape, but trying to recover from a little procedure. And meanwhile, it's the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a Talking Animals T-shirt. And right now it's time for some animal news and announcements, starting with, on a related note to our conversation with Laura, the Humane Society of Pinellas County is doing its Adopt a Senior Pet Month, and the dog selected is Penelope, who looks very sweet and nice, and there's all kinds of cool description that I can't don't have time to read you, but you can go to humanepinellas.org and find out about Penelope. And you can also go there to find out about tomorrow. They're having a comedy show fundraiser at Snapper's Grill and Comedy Club. And so that's going to, the show I think is going to get underway at 6:30. And you can find out about cost and how it works and some of the performers by again going to humanepinellas.org. And one last reminder, we covered this a couple times during our chat with Adam, but again, this Saturday is the 7th annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest at Cotenchobe Fort Brooke Park, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. In addition to speakers like Adam and many others, there'll be music, and of course, there'll be all kinds of food vendors and exhibitors and animals to adopt and movies. And actually, I don't know if they're doing movies, but they are doing speakers, of course. So anyways, it's quite an array of things. It's a full day of activity, or if you only have an hour or two to get by, you can go by and sample. Definitely want to make time to get over there. So you can go to TampaBayVegFest.org and find out more information, especially if there's something you want to see at a certain time. So I think that might conclude our quick announcements for today. Duncan Strauss, you are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt. The first person calls 813-239-9663 and correctly defines this animal song. This one was intended to be a nod both to WNF's fabulous tribute show, The British Are Coming Again, which happened last Saturday at Skipper's, though the song we're going to be listening to now, it's from the band in question's later era, and the song is also a nod to a former member of the band performing this particular song at Desert Trip recently, but was running desperately behind last week, and so on the fly, I jettisoned the whole Name That Animal Tune segment, thereby foregoing the promotion of the tribute show. So I'm sorry about that. It felt really crummy afterward when I realized exactly what I had done. Anyways, meanwhile, carrying on, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune? Either way, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next, but it amounts to 2 hours of radio activity. Again, he'll be fielding your calls about the election and other matters, no doubt, as well. I'll be back next Wednesday, November 16th, when my guest will be Alexandra Horowitz, the professor and author of, most recently, Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. Meanwhile, please visit TalkingAnimals.net, where you can find audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and all the other fascinating news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. All right, we have a bunch of phones. Lines lit up. Let's try to take one. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. You're live on the air. Can you name this animal tune?
Pigs by Pink Floyd.
That's good. Do you have the... if you get a bonus, possibly, if you can tell me the parenthetical thing. It is one of the pig songs. Do you happen to know what it says after that? That doesn't matter. All right.
On a wing.
Well, close enough. It was pigs, three different ones, but the main thing is you knew it was pigs, so you are a winner. What is your first name, sir?
John.
John, okay, I'm going to come back and get your information and send you off a Talking Animals t-shirt. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And we will catch you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwashi, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Hang in there. Hang in there. Hang in there.